So this is my fanciful picture of atmospheric neutrinos. I don't think we have to do much of a pedagogical introduction. You know they're made by cosmic rays high in the atmosphere, and then they go down to a mountain like Kinoyama, under which is the Super Kamiokande detector, and everyone knows it's just a little bit of distance away from the Eiffel Tower, which is where we are now, in the shadow of Mount Everest. So, this of course is a report on behalf of the collaboration. We're about 140 authors, 35 institutions, US, Japan, Korea, and Poland. And the detector now has, thanks to an unfortunate accident, divided itself into three distinct phases of operation. Mostly what I'll be talking about today are the results from Super K1, which took data from 1996 to 2001, had the fiducial mass of 22.5 kilotons, 11,000 photomultiplier tubes, 40% photocathode coverage, and outer detector, which is very valuable for vetoing cosmic rays and studying exiting particles. After the accident, we've been running in a phase that we call Super K2. It will run till October 2005 with about half the phototubes, mostly the ones that survived the accident. And now they're covered with acrylic shields, as you've seen before. We did fully restore the outer detector for no other reason than with a compromised inner detector, it's best to have the veto operating as well as possible. And this was in time for the K to K beam to be resumed. So I'll give a brief insight into this this data set, but we don't have much in the way of atmospheric neutrino results. And then in early 2006, we'll restore the rest of the photomultiplier tubes and eventually be prepared for a new neutrino beam. So here's my two slides on Super K2 performance. Basically, for high energy events like atmospheric neutrinos, we're in much better shape than the case for solar neutrinos, although Nakahara-san showed you impressive results yesterday. As I said, we aren't in the stages where we have any atmospheric analysis, no oscillation studies, but I just want to show you a little bit about what these events look like, because for us to be able to reconstruct and select this data is very valuable for characterizing the performance for the K2K beam. Of course, it has the additional handle of the beam timing, so the data reduction is somewhat simpler. So events still stand out quite a bit. This is an event with every other phototube hit. It's clearly a sharp muon-like ring. This one does happen to be a K2K event. Our group has already worked on the energy scale and studied several different of the handles that we have. For example, fitting the distribution of photoelectrons for the K electrons that follow cosmic ray muons, and finding the pi zero mass peak for two showering E-like rings, and then studying the amount of light emitted by cosmic ray muons of varying energy, those that stop out in the detector where you can measure the angle as an independent measure of momentum, and then those that go through. And the energy scale is good to about 2%, basically the same as in Super K1. Particle ID, of course, is a very critical component for any analysis, either with K to K or Super K. And in the sub-GV range, you can see that the data in Monte Carlo are in very good agreement, and there's an extremely strong separation. And then ring counting is one of the areas that's also relatively important. For muons, there's a fairly clear distinction. For electrons, it's not so clear. This is the merged data sample. Single rings are on this side, multi-rings are on this side. It's some sort of likelihood function. Again, you can see this reasonable agreement between data in Monte Carlo, although you can imagine there's some sort of systematic uncertainty associated with exactly how this is done, and we've enlarged that systematic uncertainty for the analysis that we're doing now to take into account this. So that's an area we're still working on. All right, so this is what I have to show you for Super K atmospheric neutrinos. Of course, we have been reducing the data set. We have 311.5 live days, and we find that the event rates are basically consistent with those found in Super K1. When we measure double ratios, we find numbers that are basically consistent with those found in Super K1. And when we look at the zenith angle distributions, we see spectral angular distortions that are consistent with the parameters that we found by fitting the data from Super K1. We've also reduced upward-going muons, both stopping and through-going. And again, we see zenith angle distortions in the data compared to expectation. And so everything is basically consistent with what we've looked at so far. We just haven't done any sort of oscillation analysis.
All right.
So I'll spend the rest of the talk on the final results, or the preliminary final results from Super K1. Of course, rebuilding the detector, trying to understand Super K2 data, make new reconstruction algorithms has been a big competition with finalizing papers and analysis for Super K1. So there's a big overlap in time and effort, and it's all the same people. So it's really quite a battle. We have a number of papers in progress, which I really won't go into much. There are various things that we don't see, so maybe they're not quite so interesting at this time. We've certainly done neutrino astronomy. We're looking for proton decay all the time. We haven't looked in all the channels yet. And of course, atmospheric neutrinos are a big background for that. Each of these topics has the paper in some sort of stage of progress. What I'll concentrate on today, though, is taking the Super K1 atmospheric neutrino data set and telling you about the characteristics that we do observe, or at least can hope to observe, of standard neutrino oscillation. Well, one of the analyses that we've presented before, new tau appearance, now we're trying to put that back into a, you know, we're reevaluating exactly how we do that. That's under study. So the last results that were presented at whatever conference will be the last you see, I believe, until we've got a new analysis all tied together. So nothing on that. But then in this talk, I'll tell you about the full SK1 data set analysis. This is basically the oscillation studies that arrives at confidence intervals, parameter measurements. And this paper is essentially ready. It should be submitted within the month. And then there's a topic also on neutrino oscillations where we're looking for a characteristic that should be there. It's the oscillatory signature. It's an L/V analysis. It's been published, at least in preprint form, and the referee comments are now in our hands and should be published in the journal very shortly. And I'll talk about that since it hasn't been widely discussed yet. And then finally, we have improved and revised a three-flavor analysis. I think you've seen the contours before. This is really a preliminary result because I think we have quite an opportunity to improve the studies. So I would expect a paper in a year or so. All right, let me just mention one of the powerful things that comes along with atmospheric neutrinos, though, are these exotic scenarios. I want to update a couple plots for the record. One of the things that we do when we study neutrino oscillations, we consider whether or not there could be an admixture of sterile neutrinos. And this is the updated analysis for Super K1. And you can see we limit it to somewhat less than 20% as an admixture. And also, and this will come up again a little bit later, we do have some indirect handle on neutrinos and antineutrinos. Not direct the way MINOS does with a magnetized detector, but they have different cross-sections and different fractions in the data sample. And so you can do things like turning the delta M squared differences on and off at different levels for neutrinos and antineutrinos and set limits on CPT violation. There's also a number of other CPT violation studies that can be done. And basically, atmospheric neutrinos are just a fantastic place to exclude any sorts of unusual or exotic scenarios generated typically by theorists where there's something in the neutrino sector that makes them particularly sensitive. For example, this new idea from the Seattle group about neutrinos whose delta M squared varies with content of the mass they're passing through, we should be able to set very good limits on that too, and a student is now working on that. Now, the features that make atmospheric neutrinos so powerful for this sort of analysis are also what give us a good handle on neutrino oscillations. They basically cover a tremendous dynamic range. Considering the distance from the nadir to the detector, or just overhead around 15 kilometers of the detector, we have about three decades of path length. And you pass through the horizon very rapidly, and that turns out to have an important effect on some of our ability to do analysis. We have a mixed beam of neutrinos and antineutrinos and electrons and muons. Again, that's an important handle. However, since it's all mixed together and we can't control it as well, it maybe is a disadvantage compared to long Bason experiments. But there's a lot of important characteristics that we can rely on, like a well-predicted flux ratio. Here you see the ratio of 2:1 for low-energy electron and muon-type neutrinos that comes from pion decay. And then at higher energies, the flux is predicted to be very up-down symmetric. So those are all important handles. So as far as this Super K1 analysis being some sort of update, there's a few different things that have changed or improved since what we presented before. Not all of it are doing. For example, we do rely heavily on flux calculations, and Professor Barr will give a presentation summarizing his work and with the Bartel group and also that of the Hondon collaborators. They have better understanding of the flux of neutrinos thanks to better data on primary cosmic rays and now an important 3D treatment of the secondary particle transport, which had been neglected in the old days. And this is the sort of thing where there can be further improvements by experiments that are on the table right now, such as HARP and MIP, which can study hadron production, which are important inputs to this calculation. Also, there's quite a bit of effort in neutrino interactions. There's a series of workshops called NUINT, which have been very productive. And we have tried to improve our understanding of neutrino interactions in the model. In particular, we can use results that we've learned from the K-to-K near detectors at the 1 GeV range. And again, there's another experiment on the table which could provide valuable insight. Of course, we're always trying to improve our tools. So this has the updated and improved versions of data reduction, which is now essentially fully automatic, except for some of the upward muon results. It requires a little bit of scanning. Reconstruction algorithms and the Monte Carlo has been tuned. Things like water scattering are much improved. And finally, we're going to approach this with a new fitting procedure that will allow a superior treatment of systematic uncertainties. All right. So here's a summary of the Super K1 data set that I'll be talking about. As well as the large dynamic range in path length, there's a large dynamic range in neutrino energy. And you can see by making somewhat different event selections, like fully contained electron or muon, partially contained events which exit the detector, you become sensitive to different parent neutrino energies. And it covers about 5 decades. So we have a large number of events, around 14,000 in total. And here's a breakdown of those that are used in this analysis. So we use almost everything. And the first analysis I'm talking about is this standard full analysis. We use about 80% of all the events. We don't use some of the multi-ring electron-like events or some low-energy events. And you can see that this is a very good sample for studying neutrino oscillations because, at least as far as our Monte Carlo tells us, the purity of the correct flavor of charged current is typically very high. So these are charged current NUIs for events tagged as E-like, and these are charged current NUMUs for events tagged as muons. And so, of course, the first thing that we always did when we studied these things was come up with figures of merit. These are a variety of ratios which take out some of those constraints like the mu to E ratio from Maison decay or the up-down symmetry. So here are our final to be published numbers on the double ratio, the so-called rate of muons to electrons in the data divided by muons to electrons in the Monte Carlo. And what you see here is the value plotted on the y-axis, and then a scan of what you expect for various neutrino oscillation parameters, fixing sine squared 2 theta to be 1, and then going across a wide range of delta m squared. So depending on what the true value of delta m squared is, you might expect different numbers. And we were sensitive initially over quite a wide range. Now all of these numbers, also the up-down asymmetry and the high energy events, and the ratio of stopping to through going upward going muons, which cancels out flux and cross-section uncertainties, are basically consistent with neutrino oscillations in the range of a few times 10 to the minus 3. So we should do a nice analysis of that. Of course, the way we do it is by expanding the information and using energy and direction to get path length by means of our zenith angle distributions. So this is essentially all of that data and various subsamples. We can divide it up more finely into, sub-GeV at very low energy, which has almost no directional correlation at all, or sub-GeV where the directional correlation is starting to kick in. That would be this one. And then also, of course, the upward stopping, upward through-going muon. So this covers that wide dynamic range in path length and neutrino energy. And so when we approach this data set, we're going to now use a somewhat new statistical treatment. We've been working on it for maybe a year now or so. And it does, compared to our old analysis where we had something like 8 systematic terms, we could allow certain normalizations to float. Now we can, and some of those normalizations were correlated, and we had to, you know, but we didn't treat them in a proper way. Now we can avoid double counting some of those uncertainties, as well as treat a much larger number of sources. In fact, we can pick out specific pieces of our understanding of neutrino interactions and put an uncertainty in just for that. So again, as Nakata-san says, I apologize for the complicated formula, but the point is we have a large number of bins in momentum and zenith angle. We have some large number of systematic terms that we consider. One of them, the normalization, is free, so this isn't a misprint. And then for any given data sample, we can put in a fractional change in the event rate due to any one of the parameters. So this can be as a function of zenith angle, could be as a function of energy, could be as a function of the neutrino interaction, like we might put in a coherent pion cross-section with a large uncertainty. In the end, this is a chi-square which we can solve by a set of linear equations. We just have to invert a matrix. It's much more rapid than the iterative minimization that we used to do. And before I show you the final result, let me just give you some sort of overview of the systematic uncertainties. Of course, there's a lot to talk about. We consider them in 4 major categories: the neutrino flux, neutrino interactions, and event selection and event reconstruction. So here's a variety of them. Using the statistical treatment, as with the previous one, we can see which ones are pulling in what direction and maybe get some information from it, although I don't think anything in particular stands out. As I mentioned, we do allow the absolute normalization to be free, but then we have a variety of other normalizations from event sample to event sample. It's not possible to really describe the data with just a single cosmic ray power law, although we do put in a term for that. Thanks to the flux calculations, the improved flux calculations by, for example, Honda-san, we can have separate treatment of the flux due to kaons and the flux due to pions, so we can allow that to vary and allow, you know, as we insert a systematic uncertainty for that, it will flow through the distribution of energy and zenith angles, and it'll appear where it's strongest in the total flux. Here are some of the classic ones, and these little check marks basically mean that we have them under good control. These are the ones that everyone started out atmospheric neutrino analysis being concerned with. The mu to E ratio, now that the flux groups have done a lot of comparisons, is estimated to be about 3% uncertain due to different models. 5% used to be a typical number. And zenith shapes are very well controlled. As I said, neutrino interactions are under quite a bit of study right now. We're using input from K to K to do things such as set the axial mass parameter, which is just a parameterization of the neutrino cross-section to a slightly larger value than what was originally accepted, but not very different systematically. And we can put in a variety of meson production modes and consider different models. And in event selection, everything's in pretty good shape. We have extremely small background, and our particle ID is very good, as I showed you. And then ring counting still stands out as the place where we have the biggest room for improvement. Fortunately, the worst offender, multi-GeV E-like events, showering events, as you might expect, are the most difficult, and they won't play a major role in fitting atmospheric neutrino oscillation in this analysis. So here's our contours. So the best fit value we find to be 2.1 times 10 to the minus 3 EV squared. I'll talk a little bit about best fits shortly. We would probably prefer to consider this as our definition of the preferred region. This is the 90% confidence level interval on delta M squared and in sine squared 2 theta, and that's bounded by this thicker of the red curves. And then you can see a lot of other contours to choose from. The chi-squared overall is very good, and the chi-squared for no oscillation is extremely strongly disfavored. One of the things that we can do is we can do this fit, and we can completely turn on and off different subsamples. And so here's a rather colorful plot showing if we only considered, say, the low energy range of sub-GeV events, where there's almost no directional information, so you see sort of classic neutrino oscillation deficit measurement. Sub-GeV high energy events do have directional information, so now there's some cutoff in delta M squared. Multi-GeV events is here in the back, partially contained events, multi-ring events that have a brightest ring being a muon, then upper-going muons. And the thing I want to point out, this is that 90% confidence interval now on a much expanded scale, is that in this analysis, upper muons provide the strongest constraint on the minimum value of delta M squared. And I know that's very important for upcoming long baseline experiments, exactly how low can you go. As far as the best fit point, here's our chi-squared maps setting sine squared 2 theta equal to 1, and you can see that it's a rather flat and uneven minimum in the region just above 2 times 10 to minus 3 eV squared. So there's our best fit point, but you can see that a variety of different values are accommodated, and it's jumping around in these little minima, which sort of makes it unwise to consider just the best fit point as a number. Okay. In any case, it is a best fit point. Now, the second of the topics I'll go on about is a separate analysis recently published where we'll try to make a high-resolution sample and study the L over E dependence of this data set. So this is an attempt to observe the important quantum mechanical oscillation pattern. And it will, as you'll see, this is also going to be a strong constant in delta M squared. And there's a couple exotic hypotheses which we can reject, which aren't so easy to reject using the regular data sample. The strategy here is, first of all, we need a lot of statistics since we're going to cut hard in the data. We expand the fiducial volume for fully contained events. And also, it turns out for the delta M squared that we have, it would be great if super K was just a little bit larger. By expanding fiducial volume, we can contain high energy muons a little bit better. And then the strategy is to select events that have the best L over E resolution. Here's a plot of sort of an event sample space, zenith angle versus neutrino energy. This is the oscillation band. Okay, so you can see if I fix the oscillation, the neutrino energy be 10 GeV, this is the probability you get as a function of zenith angle. And here's a few other curves. All right, so we want to see the data in here, but we want to do it in an independent way. So we're going to look at this whole region and see what the data tells us. Okay, everything in here is excluded because it's at the horizon and we have very poor measurement of L, and everything here is excluded because it's low energy and we have very poor directional measurement as well. Now, when we could make these hard cuts, there's a lot of data down in here, so we end up using only 2,700 or so events, and we have a deficit, as you would expect with neutrino oscillations. So using just a fraction of data, we'll see what we get in comparison to the previous analysis. So we bin the data as a function of L over E, and the raw events look like this. The fully contained plus partially contained sample overall is this heavy blue curve. And then just for comparison to show you what is in this interest region of interest, there's an overlay of the single and multi-ring component of it. Okay, so you can see in here, those partially contained events, the stopping and through-going, play a big role. In fact, they're mostly partially contained through-going events from 400 to 600 kilometers per GeV. Well, as you know, we take the ratio. This is the same data on a linear scale, and this is what we see. So we see a variety of data with some fairly large error bars, but in the region where you would expect oscillation based on our previous measurement delta M squared, we see that there's an evident minimum. I'll talk in a minute about how significant it is. How much time do I have? Whoa. Okay. Well, to estimate its significance, we have to have some sort of hypothesis to compare against. You can't compare against no oscillations. It's too strongly disfavored. However, neutrino decay, neutrino decoherence are something that give a fairly smooth behavior through the minimum region. And this is exactly how the resolution cut was optimized. And so if you turn it around, you could say that is about how significant the dip is. Okay, and let me then say that now using only a small subsample of data, that doesn't include upward-going muons, we have a significant alternative constraint on the minimum value of delta m squared. Okay, it's consistent with the allowed region from the full data set, and in fact, it's a little bit smaller in delta m squared. There's so much power in this data, and it agrees that the value can't be too low. And here's the best fit that we've published. So let me go very rapidly through the three flavor analysis. We don't see anything, so it's not so interesting to spend a lot of time on. In a hierarchical scenario, there's only three parameters to consider. And in fact, we can also consider normal and inverted hierarchy separately because we do have this varying composition of our atmospheric neutrino beam as a function of energy. So here's the fraction of charge current nu e and nu e bar, which changes as a function of energy. And this is a slow page to load because it's got a pretty picture. And it's a slow computer. And I've probably crashed it. It's not my computer. Okay. The gerbils are working on the wheel in there. Okay, so the strategy for three-flavor analysis is to look for enhancement at the core due to matter effects passing through the Earth. So the strategy is to bin the data very finely and look for enhancements. This is at one particular zenith angle, and you can look for matter effect enhancements. We actually make this sample somewhat larger by adding in multi-ring electrons, and we do use the PC stopped at through-going selection, which was invented for the L of Re analysis, and there's a larger number of bins, and we're using more data than in the full analysis. And so this is an example of the data where you cannot see that there's any particular electron neutrino appearance. This is the up-to-down ratio, and this is one zenith distribution where we finally binned it, and everything looks hunky-dory. So here are the confidence intervals. So this is our new preliminary final results on three flavors. This is what we've shown in the past for the normal hierarchy. We don't have a lot of power, so the inverted hierarchy looks almost the same, but it's a little bit different. And we do, in fact, favor our best fit is found at sine squared theta 1.3 equals to 0. So there's a lot of work for future long Bayesian experiments. Not surprisingly, since it's all the same data and it's finally binned, we do have a very good constraint on delta m squared. So, now I conclude. The preliminary look at Super K2 atmospheric neutrino data looks pretty good. We should be all set for the analysis that will be presented for K2K. And we have a number of final Super K1 papers in progress. Here I've talked about the characteristics of neutrino oscillation, where we clearly favor nu mu nu tau with parameters as we've described several different times in these three different analyses. And here's the overlay of all the contours, and this is the region favored at sine squared theta 1.3 from three flavors. So this is the target for future long Bayesian experiments. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your exhaustive presentation. And now, if there are few questions.
Doug?
So I note that the upper going muons, the Monte Carlo flux, has prediction has come down, and so you actually observe more upper going through going muons than the prediction. At the same time, and so the normalization, nobody, it's not very important in the analysis, but anything, I note that the low energy fluxes agree correctly, and so there has to be some energy dependent mechanism, I don't know what it is, but as you go from the low to the high energy, that changes that flux, and that also has to induce some angular dependent mechanism for the upper going muons. Can you comment on the systematic uncertainty that comes from that you've used in your analysis?
Well, there's quite a chain of reasoning to get from the low energy data up to the high energy, and it's not just a flux. Okay, there's also the cross sections, going from the cross section in water to rock, propagation of muon to the rock, data selection issues. So that's why we have these extra normalization terms. We're not really able to fit the data with one normalization that covers five decades of energy. So in that sense, the normalization is essentially free for upper muons alone. We put in our estimate of the relative say, through going to stopping uncertainty, where there's an experimental issue of, well, is it through going or stopping muon when it comes close to the phototubes? So we can put in our understanding of that. But basically, at this point, we have a big machinery. We put in a lot of systematic errors, and we think we've accounted for each one individually at the right level. And yeah, you're right, the normalization is now high. I don't particularly see any zenith angle dependent effect other than our ability to subtract background at the horizon, though. It may be something from kaon production at high energy, but that's that requires a lot more study that we have data to attack it with. Dave?